Arcadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Taylor Stokes and Jonathan Miniman, founders and co-directors of Games to Gather, and with co-director Jay Silvano about this Portland-based organization founded on the idea that play can make the world a better place for every person, gamer and non-gamer alike. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Nicole.
Good night, Doug.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th Annual Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon on Sunday, April 25th at 4 p.m. at Interstate Lanes in Portland. 12 registered bowl-a-thon teams will be bowling to raise funds for the Network for Reproductive Options Abortion Fund to help make reproductive rights a reality for those who can't afford to pay for an abortion. Again, that's the Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon, Saturday, April 25th, 4 to 6 p.m., at Interstate Lanes, 6049 North Interstate in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We bowl away our daily cares with little strikes, little spares.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th Annual Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon on Sunday, April 25th at 4 p.m. at Interstate Lanes in Portland. 12 registered bowl-a-thon teams will be bowling to raise funds for the Network for Reproductive Options.
Hey there, listeners. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Welcome to Out Loud. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Music Fest Northwest, presenting a weekend of music on the waterfront with Danny Brown, Modest Mouse, Beirut, Bell and Sebastian, Tallest Man on Earth, Foster the People, Twin Shadow, and more. Tickets and full lineup at musicfestnorthwest.com.
We'll be right back.
Hey there, listeners. This is Out Loud. Tonight we're going to hear a few pre-recorded programs. I think we're going to be listening to This Way Out, which is a queer audio magazine of sorts. Right now we have Out FM coming up. You can listen to KBOO on the internet tubes at kboo.fm. Our translator IDs. Let's see. K220HR for Hood River. K282BH Philomath. Awesome. So I'm gonna play some music for you. Maybe in a half an hour. And, just sit back and relax. I'm also inviting callers to talk about pertinent issues in the queer community, which we'll address on the second half of the show. So sweet. Awesome.
This is Naomi Brussel. I'm speaking to Jessica Stern, who is the director of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. Welcome to Out FM.
Thank you. It's my honor to be with you.
Once again. So here we are at the beginning of 2015. Eagle Hook, that's your acronym, has been working very hard all of these years. How many years has Eagle Hook been around?
Well, this year we're actually turning 25.
Wow.
So we're old enough to rent a car.
That's terrific, without paying a bigger insurance premium. So tell us what's the main issues that you've been working on, say, in this last 6 months. I mean, your people are all over the world bringing in information and doing advocacy and dealing with various diplomatic and outside of diplomatic relationships. So tell us what the main issues you think are going on right now.
Well, we work in solidarity with communities in 193 countries around
right.
the world.
So it's hard to pick out just a few.
So any conversation would be many hours long. So I assume that your listeners will want to, have this on for the next several days.
Well, they can also look at your website and educate themselves. Eagle Hook has a really interesting website that gives a lot of different issues in different parts of the world.
And we have a lot of information on at www.iglhrc.org. So if someone is interested in a particular country and we don't have the chance to cover it, you can find more information online. But I think I'd like to talk about some of the stories that have us very concerned alongside some of the stories that give us hope.
Okay.
At the moment, we are monitoring closely what's happening in Egypt, mm-hmm. what is happening in the Gambia, and what is underway in Malawi.
So let's start with Egypt.
Okay. So in October, there was a raid on a bathhouse, really initiated by an Egyptian journalist named Mona Iraki. And when the police raided the bathhouse, they rounded up the men that were assembled there. There were photographs and videos of these men being evacuated in various stages of nudity. their images have now been seen by millions of people. So whatever the state ultimately does to them, they are living precarious lives.
Mm. As are many, many people in Egypt right now. And of course, we're talking about an extremely repressive government.
I think that's one of the things that is so terrifying about the most recent raid is that the LGBT activists have really had to go underground, so their ability to respond to the situation these men now find themselves in is severely hampered. But it's also true for the mainstream human rights organizations.
Right. Everyone is afraid of arrest. There are people who are basically refugees from Egypt because they can't go back without being arrested.
That's exactly right. In fact, we had a conference call yesterday and again this morning where we talked about the number of organizations that we've worked with that are either going to be closing over the next couple of months or where the leadership has had to temporarily, they hope, flee the country.
In Egypt.
Yeah, they've had to leave Egypt. Next week, the men rounded up in the raid on the bathhouse will be tried. Local experts anticipate that they will all be convicted.
Of what?
Well, the charges they face vary, but one of the charges they're likely to face is so-called debauchery. And the minimum criminal sentence for debauchery is 3 months imprisonment, and the maximum is 6 years.
So that's one of the things you're anticipating. And you said Malawi is another place where you have major concern?
Malawi is one of those countries that isn't sufficiently politically or financially influential that the international community regularly is up to date with what's happening. But the government of Malawi has been outed for various instances of political corruption in recent years. Civil society groups in Malawi are really strong, and they are active and they are mobilized, and they're planning a demonstration on Tuesday to protest the diverting of government funds away from necessary HIV and AIDS programs towards what they see as a sort of pet project of the president and his family. Unfortunately, there's a consequence to organizing civil disobedience. A couple of the lead organizers have had to go into hiding. They're receiving anonymous phone calls from pro-government forces, and the LGBT rights activists are the ones that are receiving the highest number of threats because they're not only opposing government corruption, but they're most vulnerable because of their work they do on LGBT rights.
And in the Gambia?
The Gambia is a mess. The Gambia passed a law a couple of months ago that stipulates new criminal penalties for consensual homosexual acts. This week, I have been talking with friends and allies in Senegal because so many Gambian LGBT people have been forced to flee there. We were contacted by 8 gay men from the Gambia who are currently sleeping on a beach in Senegal and are looking for emergency services. We know of 10 men perceived to be gay in the Gambia who are facing criminal charges. And thankfully, there have been some very strong Senegalese activists and organizations that have been trying to work to support the people that have come to Senegal. So they're trying to raise money for food, for shelter, and for people to be able to start a new life. What it means long term for people in the Gambia is really quite terrifying, because even if these 10 men who are facing criminal charges are not convicted, we're still fearful for all of the other LGBT people in the Gambia. And the president is pretty deaf to political influence, so no one really has a solution yet for how to make the arrest stop, how to, you know, appeal the law, and how to ensure that LGBT people in the Gambia are going to be safe.
It's 25 years Eagle Hawk has been doing this work. And I wonder if you could say something about, like, the trends and, you know, what kind of, what happens when there's actual progress, because often there is also reaction to the progress in particular countries or in general, and coping with that kind of so-called backlash is something that you also have been very concerned about.
Well, on the positive side, with community organizing, comes change. And so when Igelhark was founded, there was this notion in the human rights arena that organizations could somehow be the voice for the voiceless. And I think there are lots of reasons why we don't use that paradigm anymore. But I would also say it's an antiquated notion because everywhere you look, there's not only LGBT communities, but LGBT activists. And that is exciting, it is thrilling, it is inspiring, and it is major change that's happened in a relatively short amount of time.
Right.
I mean, I started doing LGBT rights at the global level on as my paid job 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. And at the time, you know, we would have one contact in a country, and she or he was the only person anyone knew. And today, almost anywhere I look, I have a long list of contacts I can reach out to, queer and straight. So that's a positive thing.
Yeah.
The hard part is that when you demand your rights, people notice, and there can be backlash. And I think one of the really disturbing trends that we see right now is a crackdown on free speech, assembly, and fundamental human rights as a way of cracking down on LGBTI activism. So you see it in Russia, you see it in Nigeria, you see it in so many different countries. You see it in actually Egypt right now. There's a new law that actually prohibits local organizations from receiving funding from international sources. So, I mean, obviously that's not only an LGBT issue, but it is also an LGBT issue. And it's a tried and true tactic. Defund the movement, the logic goes, and the movement will die. But of course we know the movement won't die, but it's hard to sustain yourself when you don't have resources.
And you have particular people who are paid staff all over the world. You have a Latin American contact, you have someone who's in charge of what's happening in Asia, Southeast Asia, Middle East, in Africa, also I think in European countries probably more than one person in charge of that. What kind of support do they need to keep their work going?
First, just a quick clarification. We actually don't have anyone who works in Europe or North America on issues in those regions, in part because the allocation of resources to the LGBT movement globally is not equal. Surprise,
right.
Surprise.
Right. So, my mistake, okay.
So even though we both know there are plenty of LGBTI rights violations in our own backyard, and we could say the same about, you know, France or Spain or any other country in Europe, we focus on the Global South, not only because the need is there, but because the resources really haven't reached those communities. But what do Igelhark staff need to be able to do their work? Well, it's interesting you ask that question. Sometimes what they need is anonymity. So if you go to igelhark.org, you actually won't find the names of all of our staff. And if you were to meet them in a meeting, you wouldn't necessarily know that they work for Igelhark, because sometimes Igelhark staff's ability to be effective depends on their ability to be perceived as not LGBT, not working for an American organization. And so the way we're effective, the way people can help us actually is by understanding our need for partnerships across different issues, one. Our staff is incredibly effective because of their ability to know local context, two. Three, I would say our staff's efficacy depends on partnerships. So as a Global North-based organization, we almost never act alone. Because if we're going to be working on an issue in your backyard, who's going to know it better than you?
Right. And it's a rehash of imperialism and colonialism for people from the richer countries to impose their agendas on the people of other countries. But you're saying that sometimes it's better for people to really be in the dark, like not recognizable. How do people do that?
Well, because Igelhark thinks that a partnership model is such an effective way to make change, I can give you an example of one place where we put this. We actually structured our work around a partnership. So Igelhark had a project in a country where there's extremely high levels of violence against all people, There's no sodomy law on the books, but the morality laws are very strong, and the rule of law is weak. So in that context, what we did was actually to partner with two other organizations, one local organization and one international women's rights organization. And we had a joint staff person, and the joint staff person was based at the women's rights organization. Mm-hmm. That might sound kind of funny to some, but it makes sense to use a women's rights issue as a way to talk about challenging traditional gender roles. Right. And things of that nature. But at the same time, it was a much safer way to do the work. So that's an example where, you know, we kind of found a creative way to work in a highly volatile situation.
And many of the situations you're dealing with are quite volatile. So anything else you want to tell our OutFM audience? What they should keep an eye on? I mean, you've already talked about Egypt, Malawi, the Gambia, and Russia. Any other developments you think we should just be alert to as the months are coming along?
Let's see. Well, I think we talked about the Philippines and Chile once before, yeah. but change doesn't happen overnight, so I'll just mention again. Two issues at the country level that are hopeful. So one is we have about a five-month window when we think we have a real chance of passing a federal non-discrimination law in the Philippines.
That's great.
Which is very exciting. It's been languishing for 12 years, but we think in the next 5 months we really might get a victory. Uh-huh. So stay tuned, watch what happens in the Philippines. The Philippines is a very influential country, and it's a battleground for the Catholic Church. So we're actually in the process of drafting a letter to the Pope, asking him to encourage local Catholic organizations to oppose discrimination on any grounds.
He does have the beginnings of a reputation for being not so harsh against queer people as he was in the past, actually, in Argentina. And any place else?
Well, I want to say, you know, homophobia and transphobia in Uganda have not gone away. You know, we got a little reprieve, but one of the things that we're all watching for
because the law was deemed to be unconstitutional in the way that it was passed, but not that it was unconstitutional in its essence.
Exactly. So, you know, there's still widespread political support for the anti-discrimination bill, and we're expecting, you know, a new version of it to be introduced any day. So, unfortunately, the story of the Ugandan LGBT movement is still really unfolding. I did talk to you about Chile once before and how we have the chance of getting an excellent gender identity recognition bill there. An update for your listeners is that we're hoping that it's going to be passed by February or March. And then maybe just in summary, I would say at the very global level, the things happening at the United Nations is it's been pretty positive lately. We fended off an attack on LGBT employee benefits in the Fifth Committee of the UN General Assembly, basically over Christmas. We got a bullying resolution passed, the first in the history of the UN. And last but not least, we got a resolution passed in the Human Rights Council explicitly condemning discrimination and violence. So
those are very big achievements, really. Jessica, how do people donate to Eagle Heart?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. Please go to www.iglhrc.org. We take credit cards. We take PayPal. You can also send us a letter with a check in it. In fact, we take money in almost any form.
That's wonderful. Well, I think people really need to support your work. Thank you so much, Jessica Stern, the director of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. This is Naomi Brussel for Out.
I know where you at, but it's like double time for me, and I'm like, check. One, two. Oh, there's no hiding place when someone has hurt you.
Out Loud, KBOO's Queer Public Affairs Show. That was Wookiee's remix, it's a classic remix of Angie Stone's No More Rain in This Cloud. Now, what a classic remix. We're going to be listening to some more stuff in a minute. I just wanted to say again that I am inviting folks to call into the air room at 503-231-8187. Let's talk about a queer issue that's bothering you. I know there's a lot going on right now. Next, we have a piece about Pope Francis. And then I'll play some more music.
Okay, this is Naomi Brussel. I'm speaking to Michael Luongo, who is a writer and journalist and reports for Gay City News, New York Times, other publications. He's traveled a lot for his work, and he's covered LGBTQ issues in Iraq, Argentina, Italy, and many other countries. So welcome to OutFN, Michael.
Thanks. It's great to be back on. Thanks.
And I wanted to talk to you. We're sitting in the LGBTQ, it doesn't say Q on the outside of the building, center at New York City. And so you may hear some external noises, and that's where it's coming from. But what I wanted to talk to you about was Italy and the Pope and the Italian queer movement and what has been happening in Italy over these last couple of decades, because you've been following the situation there.
I think we first started talking a little bit off air about World Pride, which was in 2000. And though I'd been in Italy before that, it was a World Pride in 2000 was a major event where the Italian activist groups got together sort of to challenge the church and to challenge the Pope, to challenge the Vatican, and sort of, even though technically there's separation of church and state in Italy, in practice there really isn't. And it was...
So the church has a lot of domination over what happens in the political structure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the church is Italy. Italy is the church. You could sort of look at it in that way. The other issue, and, you know, this was...
We're talking about the Catholic Church,
the
by
Catholic
the way,
church,
in case you
yes,
didn't
the
realize.
The Catholic Church. And in... It's also that this is particularly strong in Rome, which is the heart of the church and yet also the capital of Italy. So you find that you may have more advances in other cities and other regions. When I was recently there, actually last year for the holidays, and that was the basis of that article that I recently had in Gay City News, you had many,
the Christmas holiday.
The Christmas holiday. The activists were talking about how, you know, they're... There's a gay governor in Puglia, there's a gay governor in, you know, in other places, but, you know, in Rome you would never have such a thing. And, you know, these are the influence of the church is what many of them had said.
So you want to tell you a little bit about what happened with that World Pride event? I mean, they managed to pull it off, even though there was a lot of opposition.
Yeah, so World Pride was in 2000. It was the very first of the World Prides. I think... You know, people may be more familiar now with Toronto and London, but which really, in my opinion, are not much more than circuit parties now. But World Pride began as a direct challenge to religious authority and how religion is used against the LGBT movement. So in 2000, it was in Rome. In 2006, it was in Jerusalem, very strongly religious cities. So in 2000, in Rome, you had John Paul II in charge of the Vatican, in charge of the Catholic Church. And a lot of drama, which you'd have in Italy anyway, but where events were constantly attempts to shut them down, attempts to take away permits, attempts to do all kinds of crazy things. Partly this is the government, partly this is Italian bureaucracy, partly this is the church. But at the end of the day, Rome's World Pride was able to be pulled off. You know, the New York Heritage of Pride actually played a role as well. You know, there I actually marched with Heritage of Pride when I when I was there in Rome that year. So this movement showed that the church could not shut down the LGBT movement, and then from that everything sort of expanded. One of the impacts physically was the concept of the gay village, which developed in Rome. And it's sort of a little bit on the outskirts of Rome, and you've got a lot of clubs and things that are all sort of together, and it happens in the parts of it actually happen in the wintertime as well, indoors, but mostly
it's
during the summer. And, you know, you have a gay bar that's right next to the Colosseum. And this is a wonderful, wonderful announcement to millions of tourists that there are gay people in Rome as well.
Right. Although the rights that they have are more limited than the rights of queer people in other Italian, other European countries.
Yeah. This is a major issue and was talked a lot, you know, for that article. Whether I spoke with the mayor of Rome, Ignazio Marino, whether I spoke with Ima Battaglia, who now she's
a
city council politician, but she used to be in charge of Mario Mieli back in 2000.
Mario Mieli is an organization, a queer organization,
yes,
named after a man.
Named after Mario Mieli.
Who committed suicide at age 30,
I think in the
1983.
80s, yeah, yeah. So all of this is still carried out in his name, and it remains, I think, the largest of the Italian groups. But it's, you are seeing that among the things that people would talk about are that the, you know, only Italy and only Greece don't have gay marriage or some kind of same-sex marriage protection. That Italy is really behind the rest of Western Europe. I mean, clearly, you know, Poland doesn't have it. The former Eastern Bloc, right. They've got a long way to go. But we're talking about Western Europe. Mm. And Italy is behind the rest of Western Europe. And that's one of the things that is constantly brought up by the activists now.
And they ascribe it to the role of the Catholic Church and the Pope?
In general, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of things Italian tradition, but a lot of Italian tradition comes out of Catholic tradition.
So let's talk about the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. and about Pope Francis, who uh-huh. prior to his elevation to be the Pope, was the Archbishop of Argentina. Was it yeah. just of Buenos Aires?
Buenos Aires.
Of Buenos
yeah,
Aires.
Of Buenos Aires.
His name was Jorge Bergoglio.
Yeah.
And he played a very key role in opposition
yes.
to queer rights in yeah. Argentina. You want to talk about that a little?
Yeah. I'll talk about that a little. I know Bergoglio, really just as a journalist does.
You didn't hang out with him.
I didn't hang out with him. But the church was one of my favorite places, and I would always photograph Midnight Mass, and I'd met him.
His particular church.
It's the most important church.
The cathedral.
The cathedral in all of Argentina. And unless you count the shrine to the Virgin of Luján. But that cathedral overlooks Plaza de Mayo, the central square in Buenos Aires. You have the Casa Rosada, which is well known for Evita's balcony, but it's also where the current president,
Evita Perón,
Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, the current president, that's where she works out of. And then this square is where the gay pride would begin and then would go up Avenida de Mayo. Now, for years, what you used to see were actually these protectors of the church who would stand on the steps of the church, the cathedral, Bergoglio's cathedral, and harass the gay people as
while they were marching by.
Yeah, as the march would begin.
It would be as if there were people standing in front of St. Patrick's on the stairs.
Yeah, on the stairs.
To protect St. Patrick.
And you'd have a line of police in between and everything. But I did find fascinating the last time that I photographed gay pride was in 2010. That was the same year that same-sex marriage became the law. And you did not have those people standing in front of the church anymore harassing because the church had lost that fight. What is interesting is what Bergoglio was trying to do, Bergoglio being Francesco Papara, Pope Francis, was this sort of compromise people talk about, but it really was not a compromise. So he was clearly against same-sex marriage, had supposedly said it's the work of the devil, to paraphrase it. There are many people unfamiliar with that fight who regard him as progressive in the press because they don't understand that he was not trying to negotiate civil unions versus same-sex marriage. Civil unions already were the law of the land in almost all of Argentina. So to say that he was progressive in promoting civil unions instead of same-sex marriage is not progressive. He was trying to prevent more progress from going on because civil unions already existed since 2003 in Buenos Aires. It was not throughout the country, but throughout most of the major cities. So he was not being progressive. And that was the Bergoglio that I knew. The other thing about his cathedral was it was often splattered with red paint. It was often graffiti covered because there were so many people angry at the backwards nature of the church.
Not just the queers.
Not just the queers, but many, many people. You know, Cristina Fernandez, the president of Argentina, she hated Bergoglio. She would do anything she could to sort of screw a knife into the church. Mm. Now, Pope Francis, Bergoglio is far more important in the world than Cristina Fernandez, and you see her all the time now in Rome, dressed in black, having mate, which is an Argentine tea with the Pope. But he was also not very progressive on women's issues as well.
And still is not.
And still is not. But he did, from what I recently read, he had said a few good notes about the whole debate with American nuns. There's this debate about American nuns
having investigated
more
at this point.
And as I understand it, he'd said a few good words in favor of the American nuns.
Because the American nuns have been very progressive
in
many ways.
Yeah.
So he was elevated. He was elected.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is an election.
Yeah.
Do you think that any sense of whether the people who elected him were progressive and expected him to act in a progressive way? Did anybody have a sense of what they expected from him?
That's really hard to say. And
this is all speculation.
This is all speculation. What's very interesting is that immediately upon his selection, I did a piece for Gay City News on, will the Catholic Church now lose power and influence now that Bergoglio, now Pope Francisco, is in charge because of the decline in the power of the church in Argentina? Would we see more of the same?
Declined in many places.
It's declined in many places. But you could specifically state that the church lost its biggest fight in Argentina, same-sex marriage. Will we have more of this sort of backwardsness, this sort of lack of progressiveness will the church be even, it was very unimportant in many ways under Benedict, his predecessor, who was not popular at all.
No, and it wasn't progressive in any way.
It wasn't progressive in any way.
It was really regressive.
But would we have more of the same? And I was very surprised by Bergoglio, and I think by Pope Francis, and I think almost everyone is. Now, is this...
But he's made very kind of vague statements about whether or not he has any... I mean, what he said... There was a question about whether gay people were sinners or something like that put to him.
Well, there was the whole thing about who am I to judge, which was about...
He said that.
Yeah, which was about gay priests, actually, who would exist. And we know that there's tons of gay priests.
Yes. We have met them, and lesbian nuns.
Yeah, so... And so we know all about that. And so his statement... which he'd made actually on a flight from Rio de Janeiro or to Rio de Janeiro, was related to that, was about that.
During the transition.
Well, he was already Pope.
Right.
But I think he was visiting, I can't remember.
He had to go home and get his stuff in Buenos Aires.
And I guess FedEx wasn't sending it. Mm-hmm. And, but what I find very fascinating is there isn't a change in doctrine. This was made clear in many of the interviews that in Italy, both when I was there for the Christmas holidays last year, through the interviews I was doing up until publishing that article at Gay City News this December.
Interviews with whom?
Politicians, so Ima Battaglia, there was Sergio Lo Giudice, Andrea Macaroni. And so what you see is this new openness under the Pope, but will the bureaucracy under him change? Now, we may only be looking at this in terms of gay issues, but LGBT issues, but if you look at some other changes that he's doing, among them, for instance, he's changed the whole Vatican bank structure,
mm-hmm.
To try to prevent corruption. He's doing some other things where he was not paying certain bonuses that were expected, which are a form of corruption, and he'd mm-hmm. stop that.
He spoke out just a week or so ago against very bad behavior he was saying was existing in the highest level of the church.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was castigating them.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that you will see, doctrinal changes,
uh-huh.
but you may see bureaucratic changes.
So
now,
not doctrinal.
We don't know. I think that, with the whole concept of the family and the importance of, and this is what also had come out of the article in Gay City News, was the most important unit in Italy is the family. But the family is changing. And it's not just gay families, but also mixed divorced couples who are no longer living with people who live in sin, quote unquote.
No, I think it's important for us to remember that there were left-wing governments in Italy for a long time after the Second World War, and that there were progressive people who had very little to do, if anything, with the church and wanted, you know, nothing to do with their doctrine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is a progressive, you know, workers' history in Italy.
Yeah. This left-wing movement, this sort of communist, socialist movement that still exists. You know, Italy has a lot of parties.
Yes.
It's not just Berlusconi and the, you know, these crazy right-wing corrupt politicians that are great for tabloids. One of the things that I think is very interesting about this whole, whether it's doctrinal, whether it's just this sort of breath of fresh air, perhaps, that the Pope is bringing in, is that I used to write for an Italian-American magazine, and I wanted to do some stuff on gay Italian-Americans. And the editor said, you know, I've got these spaghetti pot stirring grandmothers, and I can't do articles like that. You know, and what I find very fascinating is those spaghetti pot stirring grandmothers listen to the Pope. So if the Pope is telling them maybe to be a little more accepting of
their
and maybe he's
children,
not saying it directly. Yeah. These conversations are happening at dinner tables everywhere that Catholics listen to the Pope. Mm-hmm. And so whether there is a doctrinal change or not, I think that these create good conversations among millions of households that would never have occurred without him making these statements. And yes, that might mean that the church is window dressing, as some of the politicians in Italy worried about. But conversations can create forms
social
of change,
social change.
Yeah. And that's where I think is interesting. And I think one of the other things about the Pope, and again, this is speculation, is, you know, he had a boss before he was when he was in Argentina.
So he had to do what the boss said.
He had to do whatever the boss said.
And it was Benedict, and prior to that, it was John Paul II, and prior to that, it was John Paul II.
And that was a very backwards view on LGBT and other issues. But now he's the boss, unless you believe that there's the boss above him.
Maybe the boss above him is telling him something new.
Maybe, maybe that boss is communicating in new ways to him. So, you know, now he's the boss, and maybe this was the way he always wanted to be, and now he can be that way.
Right. So that's what we may hope.
Yeah, that's what we may hope. Now, the church is a huge, huge institution.
It is,
and very
an
hard
international bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Amazing. So it's been around for
been
a couple
around
thousand
for about,
years.
About 2,000 years, I hear.
So, Michael, thank you for your analysis.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the work that you're doing. Yeah. And when you get more news about that, please come back, and we'll be, you know, in touch with you also, because there's so many other issues that you're dealing with in other countries.
Yeah.
So that was Michael Luongo, who is a journalist and writer, and who has been telling us about Italy and the Pope and the queer movement there. This is Naomi.
To Out Loud, KBOO's queer public affairs show. We just heard a piece by Out FM. Again, we're still inviting callers to just talk about pertinent queer issues in the world around us. Right now, behind me, I've got Code 9's Black Sun on Hyperdub from 2011. A notoriously queer label. I'm gonna let this play, and we might hear a little bit of some This Way Out. Listeners, this is Out Loud, KBOO's Queer Public Affairs Show. Right now, we've got Floating Points with Myrtle Avenue. Before that, we had FKA Twigs' Ultraviolet from EP2. We're just winding down on Out Loud. Next week we have Alan back with some very interesting material. I highly encourage anybody who's interested in queer public affairs to tune in next week. This time on KBOO. All right.
And the time is 7 o'clock, straight on the dot. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio, coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, happening